Let's start with Paul Nolte today, senior wealth advisor and market strategist Murphy and Sylvester. Some interesting numbers in the business world this week. Which one do you want to start with, Paul?
Maybe earnings this morning, but I think probably the one that got investors' attention was the consumer price index yesterday.
Yeah, well, that's the one I thought you would think of. Why don't you start there just for a second? What happened and what does that mean?
Well, the consumer price index came in below expectations, which is good, which means inflation's coming down a little bit quicker than expected. And the core rate also declined. So, again, it's in line with what the Fed is looking at as far as we're getting better numbers, inflation is starting to come down to target. And the implication because of that and the way the market reacted yesterday was that means the Fed now has some room to cut interest rates. And that's what Wall Street's been kind of hanging their tongue out for quite some time.
Yeah, but didn't markets initially go down yesterday?
They actually, yeah, once the numbers were released in the pre-market, there was a strong rally, and that reversed. And then as the market opened up, the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 finished down. But the very broad market, there were a lot more stocks up than down yesterday, and the small-cap stocks were up over 3%. So there was a 4% difference between the S&P 500 and the small stocks. So it was really a day yesterday where a lot of the megas, the big Magnificent Seven,
yeah,
did poorly and everything else did well.
Yeah, I think it's the first time in memory I heard negative in NVIDIA news. But what do we want here? We do want broader participation. So lower interest rates, I presume, are good, right?
The question is, why are interest rates coming down? So the Fed does not cut interest rates when the economy is doing well. The Fed normally will cut interest rates when the economy is doing poorly in an effort to try to get the economy going again. So in our way of looking at things, it's not so much the inflation numbers that's going to drive the Fed. It's going to be unemployment. And we saw that last week the unemployment number ticked up a little bit, yeah, to 4.1%. It's been trending higher over the last 6 to 7 months. That is, again, if the unemployment rate gets around 4.3, 4.4, then I think the Fed has reason to start to cut rates.
And then what happens?
Then I think the equity markets struggle, and I think it's going to be the large stocks that are going to struggle. The small stocks, like yesterday, and some of the value stocks, they've been kind of meandering around for the last 2 years and really have gone nowhere. It's been really the top 7 to 10 stocks that have really carried the averages. And I think that reverses. Some of those stocks, I think, are very overvalued, will probably come down. Mm-hmm. And investors will rotate, as they did yesterday, to the smaller and more value-type names.
So as unemployment goes up, fewer people are out there to purchase products, and the markets don't like that, even though another way to look at it, clearly this isn't the deciding factor, would be that lower interest rates are good for business and they can invest more in people and capital. But that's less likely to happen than actually they'll suffer because unemployment is higher and there are fewer dollars out there. Is that it?
There's less spending. So, yes, really what happens is you think about it from this perspective, the unemployment rate goes up. The retail sales spending continues at a pretty good clip until you lose your job, and then that falls off. So that's why I said when that unemployment number goes up, you have more people now that are not spending the way they used to spend, and it brings down that economic activity. It should bring inflation down. And as we saw in 2000, 2008, even though the Fed was cutting interest rates, the economy was slowing down faster than what the Fed was cutting rates. And we saw the equity markets suffer over a course of 6 to 12 months.
But, Paul, we've been so hyper-focused on these interest rates for a couple of years now, and people are locked into mortgages. They're paying more for a car. Lord knows they're paying a lot on a credit card. So I wonder which is the least painful path? Do we want interest rates to come down and the markets suffer a little bit? Or do we want the markets to stay high, but a 30-year fix stays at 7%, which is better overall for the country?
I mean, for the country as a whole, I think we would like to see inflation come down. I mean, certainly that's been painful because, again, you and I go to the grocery store weekly. We go to the gas station weekly. We spend money on a regular basis, and that's really where the impact happens. So we'd really like to see those inflation numbers come down. The hard part is, how do you get energy prices down? How do you get egg prices down? Raising interest rates is not necessarily the solution to that. It is complicated from that perspective. We've seen bird flu, et cetera, and that's had an impact on those types of products. So I'm not sure that interest rates is the answer. It right. is a lot more than that. But interest rates certainly is a component to it.
But prices they just did come down. That was the report. I mean, some areas were higher, but overall, the prices have been coming down, right? Or growing slower, correct?
That's the key. They've been growing at a slower rate. They are still rising, but just rising at a slower rate. So it's not as noticeable as it was maybe a year ago when you went to the grocery store and you noticed, holy cow, you know, egg prices went up, 15, 20 cents from the last time I was here. Maybe it's a penny, maybe it's down a penny. So those types of relationships continue to be an issue. And that's what I said, we're looking for more supply to bring those prices down. And that's, again, somewhat of a function of interest rates. Interest rates should come down at some point. But again, it's going to be because of slower economic activity.
Mm. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're talking to Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist over at Murphy and Silvest. What's happening today then? You kind of walked us through what happened yesterday and maybe just sort of the big picture. Markets are doing really well today. Why is that, Paul?
Yesterday, for the big averages, it was a dip, and investors are buying the dip. We've seen a little bit of the continuation from yesterday. Small stocks doing very well, but I think a lot of investors looking at Apple, Microsoft going down as much as they did yesterday, were looking at it as a good reason to buy. So, again, it's still a thought that in the long run, cutting interest rates is going to be good for the overall markets. I think in the long run, you're going to see some reversion to the mean where those stocks that have done very well over the last 6 months to a year probably don't perform as well going forward. And those stocks that have done poorly over the last year or so do better. And that's kind of what we've been seeing in the market the last couple of days.
Kind of hard to imagine, though, how the market operates without the big seven leading the way, you know. I mean, put it this way, we're at 40,000 on the Dow now. Do you think we'll be at 40,000 on the Dow at the end of the year or after the election?
We may be, maybe even a little bit higher. But that's, you know, again, when you look at how the market has moved, the S&P 500 is up, let's call it 16% year to date. If you take the S&P 500 and equal weight all of those stocks coming into this week, it was pretty much unchanged to up 2%. So that's the impact of the Apple, Microsoft, and NVIDIA. So, yeah, I do think the markets can still do well, relatively speaking. But, again, it's where you want to have your money, and I think it's going to be somewhere away from those magnificent seven.
I kind of like the idea, though, of the rest of the market participating. You know, if the numbers don't fall off, but more companies, maybe with less of a bite, are the ones that are lifting the market, that's a good thing, huh?
It can be. But, again, remember that what's driven the market has been those top seven. So if those top seven don't do well, the average may not do well, even though the average portfolio or the average stock does better because their weights are much lower. They don't have the impact on the average. So that's where the averages can be kind of deceiving. You have to understand how they're constructed and how they're working. So we think there's a little bit of an unwind over the next year or two compared to what we've seen over the last year.
Well, who do you think is overvalued? You mentioned NVIDIA and Apple. Is that what we're talking about? Can you give me some names? Who do you think is overpriced?
Yeah, Microsoft.
Right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Microsoft, NVIDIA, Apple. If you look at them in a price to sales or a price to earnings valuation, they're at among their highest levels ever. And the expectation is that they're going to continue to grow their earnings at 15, 20, 30% per year, and their revenues are going to grow at 10 to 15%. That's hard for those types of companies to continue that type of growth. Is the market for AI that big? Is there going to be that type of a demand for those products, those services in the end markets? Or have we built in too much expectation? And yes, there's going to be some growth, but maybe not at that pace. And that's where I think the rubber meets the road, is expectations, I think, are far ahead of maybe the reality of the growth in AI over the next decade or so.
Well, where do you think there's value right now? Where's a good buy?
I think the good buys are in small stocks in general. And I think, too, if you look at basic materials, you look at industrial names and maybe even some healthcare, again, those stocks really haven't gone anywhere. They continue to provide good earnings. They're continuing to grow their revenues. They're just ignored. They're out of the limelight. So I think even if the economy does slow some, many of these companies are today priced for that slowing economy. So when it does come, it won't be a surprise. And those companies paying good dividends will do okay in that type of an environment.
You think the Fed's going to cut it twice this year?
I think once. I'm not so sure twice. And that once is questionable because, again, they're so data dependent. So let's say next month the inflation numbers are a little bit worse. Well, that pushes off the possibility of a rate cut. So I don't think they have a clear path as to what they want to do. So it is very much as the data comes in, then we flip some more coins and kind of figure out what the Fed's going to do.
You have any feelings about the auto sector in general?
It's an interesting sector in the fact that we are seeing pickup in some EV sales on a year-over-year basis. It's not the pickup I think that many would like to see. They would like to see a lot more. Ford had very good F-150 sales. That is, from an economic perspective, actually pretty good. So I think the autos are doing okay at this point, but it's not a sector that we normally will invest in. They don't generate the cash flow that we really like to see.
Is the question for somebody like you or maybe some investor, what's the next thing that people are going to want to be buying? What's the next thing that will bounce back up?
That's a tough one because otherwise you and I might not be chatting. I could be on my own private island if I knew that. That's the tough part. And I think some of it with AI is going to be who's going to be the users, who is going to be the beneficiaries of AI outside of the big tech firms. Where does it get used? How does it get used?
Medicine.
How do we
I'll guess medical.
Get more information out?
I guess medical.
Medical, I think it's going to be interesting. And there's still some glitches with it, but I think medical, I think, is going to be one of the big beneficiaries. They've tried it now with drive-thrus at McDonald's and Wendy's and
yeah.
Not the greatest success there.
Yeah.
So there's still some bugs. It's not as clean as we'd all like it to be. So there's a learning process for sure.
Mm. We're learning a lot with Paul Nolte, senior wealth advisor and market strategist, Murphy and Sylvest. MurphySylvest.com. Paul, really interesting today. Thanks for your help.
I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Here's Robert Sevum, who is the president of Chicago, the president of the Chicago region of Savills. Savills.com is the website. And Robert's here to talk a little bit about the commercial real estate scene and how it's doing. Thanks for joining us, Robert. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. I always love joining your call. Thank you so much.
So just give us a heads up on what you do and then how's it going?
Absolutely. So my firm represents the interests of users of space in the office market, industrial market, and other areas. And we advise our clients who are companies to help them think about all areas of recruiting and retention of their talent and how that manifests itself in real estate decisions, which right now are obviously very topical as we start thinking about the role of the office and the role of manufacturing and thinking about how the real estate markets have been affected by the financial markets and how we can be safe and also take advantage of some incredible economic opportunities for our clients.
Right, because there's a lot of inventory out there?
There is a lot of inventory. There is, we're seeing very, very high numbers in terms of vacancy and availability. But it's very important for people to understand that it is a tale of two cities. It's bifurcated. So if you look at Class A buildings, all these buildings that you know that are these glass and steel trophy assets, you know, as you sit here in downtown Chicago, many of those buildings have a proverbial line out the door of tenants looking to occupy those buildings, both because they represent a flight to quality for their organizations, but now more than ever, they also represent a flight to capital, which is they're healthy in many cases. Whereas on the other hand, when you look at these data points around vacancy and office space subleasing data points, which are significant, many of them tend to be, not exclusively, but there is a theme, they tend to be in buildings that aren't of the same classification or may not be as well located. And so as a result, they're suffering more, and it becomes more challenging for those owners to either invest in the building because they can't rationalize doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And tenants who are in the market and their leaders look at those options as possibly subpar relative to the top end of the market. And if we're in a state of consciousness right now, which is focused on health and well-being, proximity to transit, the ability to retain and attract talent that will stay with the company and feel like they're culturally engaged, you really have to have the best of all worlds, neighborhood-wise and building-wise. So the have and the have-nots is really developing into a wider chasm than we've ever seen.
I'm going to ask you where the haves are and where the have-nots are, but do you represent the landlord or do you represent the tenant? Are you trying to help the building owners attract people, or are you trying to help the businesses find the best deal?
We exclusively represent the tenant. We do no work on behalf of the landlord, so we are finding the best solution for our tenant clients.
And where is the hot spot right now? Where does everybody want to be?
Most tenants are looking for solutions where they can get their employees to come into the office as often as possible, to be as productive and connected with the organization as possible. So you need to take into consideration close proximity to major transit zones. So, for example, being near Ogilvy, being near Union Station mm-hmm. is key in many cases. You have to marry that, though, with building inventory. Are the right buildings near those stations, and do they have the right space availability, right? Are they new generation buildings? Are they second generation buildings? Then you also have another subset of employee base that might be more conscious in terms of taking the L, at which point you might be more centered around, you know, L stop exits and entrances. So it's really important to understand where the commuting patterns of your people are.
Yeah.
But as a trend, John, what you're seeing is more and more tenants are focused on opportunities in the West Loop. That is where the highest concentration of tenant activity and leasing is occurring.
I guess I'm not surprised to hear that. I'm also glad to hear that if Ogilvy and Union Station are focal points for what you do, I mean, that's in the Loop, that's downtown. So I think that's good for all of us if we can get people to come in from the suburbs and land there, right?
That's exactly right. And many of the landlords who have the capacity to do so have recognized this, and they are investing in their buildings so that the journey from suburban homes to the trains to the office building is this journey of tremendous experience. So when they arrive at their building, they have upgraded lobby experiences, they have upgraded amenities, and to the point where those can't be replicated at their homes. So the idea of coming in isn't more about just sort of showing face time and being part of an organization because that's the demand. It's because you're actually gaining an experience that is superior to what you can do at your house, right? And so that is a key draw for a lot of these buildings, and the reason why being close to the trains makes a lot of sense.
Is it a buyer's market then?
It is absolutely a buyer's market. It's important that the buyer knows which buildings can transact and are healthy, and it's important to know exactly what they are able to do. And at some point, that well will dry up. You know, a lot of these buildings who are being incredibly generous with their transaction packages will do so until they hit a point where it no longer makes sense for the health of the building, because the value will simply diminish too much after they buy these deals, so to speak.
Yeah.
So understanding that window and understanding which owners are actually doing it is part of the magic of what we help our clients understand.
Well, are some of those areas already sold out? I mean, is it hard to get into River North or Fulton Market?
Fulton Market and River North still have opportunity. I would say that in the West Loop, there are select Class A or trophy assets that are really getting at their limit in terms of availability, certainly in the high rise. And those that have some unique vacancy are chasing transactions in the most aggressive of ways. And we're seeing record concession levels here in downtown Chicago, the highest number of tenant improvement and free rent packages that we've ever seen in the commercial real estate market.
How big is a firm that you would represent? Are we talking about 10 people coming into town or 1,000 people?
We represent firms of all sizes. You know, if you looked at the averages, they're oftentimes, you know, floor to two floors of office space. But right now we're working with some of the biggest tenants in the entire downtown Chicago market. And oftentimes we'll help a company that's looking to start a two-person organization. So we don't have limitations on our size, but we do typically operate in the middle and higher end of the size marketplace.
One last thing. We often talk about occupancy rate in the city in these buildings, but I'll bet you're going to tell me it depends on where. Some places might be 90%, some places might be 40%, right?
You answered the question.
Well, I hate it when that happens. who do you feel bad for then? Who's struggling right now? What areas of the city?
Where I feel bad is I feel bad for those owners who came into Chicago or were already in Chicago. They built bought a sound building, perhaps somewhere in the middle of the loop in a location that previously wasn't critiqued for being a little bit darker in terms of the light and air that it takes in terms of obstruction around it, where maybe the amenity levels were considered good, but not necessarily excessive. And that over the years, the tenant base that they had in their building perhaps didn't have the blue chip nature of their competitive building sets.
Mm-hmm.
And so as COVID hit, and erosion of certain companies occurred, and this idea of flight to quality, flight to experience, and flight to capital became a very central focus of companies in order to create a jolt for their employee base. Those buildings sat in the middle and became far less noticeable, so to speak, and haven't had the ability to revitalize, nor can they generate the capital or the justification to spend to try and do that, because the baseline prioritizations or the baseline criteria that those buildings offer are no longer desirable. They may be too dark. They may be a little older in infrastructure. The floor plates may have too many columns for efficiencies. And all of a sudden, what seemed like a pretty good purchase by a buyer 5 or 7 years ago is now considered a flyover zone. And I feel bad for them because a poor strategy, because you can't forecast these types of things. But that's the reality of the situation.
We're out of time, but I wonder how many of them will do what the Tribune did then and just say, all right, we'll take the tower and go condo. Is that maybe an option for some of these people?
Well, certainly you're aware of Mayor Johnson's revitalization program on LaSalle Street. And I think a number of them will go through that process. But it is not easy for quote unquote any old building to kind of redefine their existence in terms of a residential building, because a number of them have issues as it relates to floor plate sizes, infrastructure.
Right.
They
problems.
Weren't designed as residential buildings. So it's
All right.
challenge.
Robert Savills is the president, Chicago Region, Savills, SAVILLS.com. It's the website. And Robert, you're always a great conversation. Join us again.
Well, I'd love to. Thank you so much and have a great weekend.
More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A major financial boost for Stellantis will help expand its Belvedere plant and create more jobs. The federal government has awarded the company $335 million to transition the plant to manufacture electric vehicles. The Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act included nearly $2 billion for EV manufacturing. This is the second largest grant from the program. Stellantis reopened the Belvedere plant and announced plans to make a mid-sized EV truck there. It also plans to build a battery plant nearby. Both facilities could eventually employ up to 5,000 workers. Illinois is among 8 states receiving federal funds from the program. The Revival Food Hall in Chicago's Loop will be revived under a new name and new ownership. The owners of the food court on Clark Street said it would close by the end of the month because they failed to get favorable lease terms. Now, an Atlanta-based hospitality firm has announced acquisition of Revival and says it plans to keep everything the same except for the name. The new name for the food court is expected to be announced later. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
It's a Mr. Fizz Friday. Gardening guru Jim Fizzell has some work for us to do right after we thank the Chevy, Silverado, and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Mr. Fizz, gardening guru Jim Fizzell, what kind of work do you have planned for us this weekend?
Well, you know, this is a wonderful time of year. In fact, this is a time we gardeners are waiting for. It's time to reap the benefits of all the hard work. So I need to talk about some of the things that are coming into production and what we need to make the best use of them. First of all, let's talk about the vegetables. You need to harvest the stuff for the best quality, and that means fully ripe for most things. The tomatoes need to be red. Acorn squash, how do you know when it's ripe? You turn the thing over where it's lying on the ground. When it's fully deep yellow, almost orange, then it's ready to pick. Herbs, you want to pick those when they're young and tender, usually before they want to go into bloom. And you want to make sure that things are not overdone either. I know some people let their beans get on the vine until they're seedy. You don't want to do that. You want to pick them when they're fresh before the seeds really develop. The zucchinis, we don't like zucchinis the size of a baseball bat. You need to pick them when they're about 8 to 10 inches long. They're a lot easier to use then, and they're a lot tastier. Now, beets, 2 to 2.5 inches in diameter. If you let them get much bigger than that, they get woody. Another thing that people don't realize, a lot of the flowers that we grow in our garden can be picked as fresh flowers and used for little bouquets. Pick them early in the day, just as you would the produce. Trim the stems off and set them in 100-degree water with preservatives. Now, that makes the air that would be collected in those stems after you pick them move out, and the preservative provides a little bit of sugar for these flowers so that they last longer. After you've gotten them cut and put in 100-degree water, put them in the refrigerator for 12 hours and let them harden off. After the 12 hours, you can recut the stems and rearrange them the way you want them to brighten up the kitchen table or to give to somebody that would appreciate a little pick-me-up during the day.
Mr. Fizz, gardening guru Jim Fizzell, and if you're digging potatoes out of your garden already, it's National French Fry Day and it's National Pecan Pie Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
There is a tech hub that is part of the University of Illinois School of Agriculture, which has been awarded $51 million to do something called biomanufacturing. I'm not sure what I just said. Here's Dr. Beth Connerty to explain. Doctor, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I'm great this Friday.
I bet you are. I mean, I do actually understand a little bit having read about this, but first tell us who you are and what you've been awarded.
Sure. So my name is Beth Connerty, and I am the Regional Innovation Officer for the Illinois Fermentation and Agriculture Biomanufacturing. Oh, that's a mouthful. IFAB Tech Hub. So we are trying to grow biomanufacturing and precision fermentation in Illinois and in central Illinois.
The government's given you guys $51 million to further that. What would be the end result of this? So are you taking soybean and corn and doing something else with them?
Yeah, we are. You nailed it. We are using agricultural commodities to revolutionize manufacturing, using them as the raw materials to build and create so many chemicals and ingredients and fuels that we use on a day-to-day basis. We think it's a really exciting application of biology that can bring manufacturing to the United States and to manufacture things more sustainably.
Sustainably. I wonder what's driving this. Is it to make the world a better place, less, say, of a carbon footprint, or more efficiencies in energy, or is it just let's find more ways to use corn and soybeans?
I really think it can be both of those things. We do want to use biological processes and biological materials for manufacturing. We do think that the sustainability of that is better than using petroleum. But we also see a lot of companies that we work with going overseas to do their early manufacturing. And we think that's a missed opportunity for the U.S. economy. And I live in central Illinois, so the farmers are definitely excited about finding new markets and new uses for agricultural commodities.
What's a use that you all are excited about?
Oh, there are so many, but maybe one that some people can relate to. Collagen. Collagen is used in a lot of makeups and skincare products all over the place. I don't know if people know that it's normally a byproduct of a pig. So they actually derive collagen from animals. There are some companies out there who are actually using fermentation to make collagen that's more human-like, so hopefully more biocompatible, but no pig involved. They're using these fermentation tanks, and they're doing it with agricultural commodities as a starting material.
Is there anything about lower emissions fuels for buses and cars?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so this whole industry has grown out of, what we saw, 10, 15 years ago in ethanol for fuel. Now, I would say that the focus is very much on sustainable aviation fuel, especially as our personal cars are more and more electric. But we can definitely support sustainable aviation fuel if there are no new fuel molecules, or if we're targeting more renewable diesel for the trucking industry. All of those can be addressed through biomanufacturing.
Dr. Connerty, we have to go. I'm out of time, but I'd like to talk to you more about this on a later date. But so $51 million is coming to this project at the U of I. Is that right?
It is. We are going to get started this fall, and we are very excited.
Oh, well, then we'll visit again. Dr. Beth Connerty, with all of that other stuff she said, she's part of the College of Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois, the IFAB area. Okay. Thanks for visiting with us. Really well done.
Thank you so much.